Arm's Length Reporting, for investors who want the whole story. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in to KER Politics. Got a really good show this week. We have a new guest who is going to take over for us in terms of the first segment and the second segment. His name is Jose Nino. I'm going to ask Mr. Nino to tell you a little bit about himself. Let me just say that he is a freelance writer. He's going to go into that. I met Jose through my friend Jeff Deist down at the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. Let's start with you, Jose. Tell our audience who haven't heard you before, other than on one daily editorial, a little bit about yourself.
Well, I was originally born in Venezuela, but came to the U.S. when I was young, and I've been politically active more or less since Ron Paul's presidential run in 2008, and I got into a lot of this space through people like Ron Paul and Pat Buchanan. I'm definitely a committed nationalist when it comes to my politics, very much into the idea of protecting private property, securing the border, national sovereignty, and having a restrained foreign policy. Nowadays, I'm a freelance writer that covers a host of topics from foreign policy to border security, among other issues. And I also am the host of the El Nino Speaks podcast that you can find on Substack as well.
Okay. Now, you make a comment in the beginning of your article, "Are Neocons Still in Control?" Very interesting third sentence in some of the talking points that I have, and that is politics ain't for everybody. Tell us a little bit about your background with the Republican Party, etc., and some of the candidates that you worked with, Jose, would you?
Well, in my previous stint as a email marketer for a Second Amendment lobby, I learned pretty well, especially during my trip to state legislatures, that a lot of the Republican Party is captured by the overall political establishment. Basically, the Republicans who talk a big game about limited government, low taxes, and other so-called conservative values, they end up turncoating their constituents. So many activists that get involved in politics, especially nationalists, populists, and other people on the so-called dissident right, will need to realize they will face obstacles and they will have to be able to operate accordingly. So they will have to put pressure on politicians that deviate from conservative norms, and that's going to not just be Democrats but also Republicans. They will have to brace themselves for the reality that Republicans will sell them out unless there's enough grassroots pressure. One thing I've learned in politics is that you can't really assume too much. You have to be willing to take proactive action against politicians that don't bend to your political will. And that's a harsh reality that most people will have to come to grips with. And if you want to be successful in the political space and realize change, you're going to have to turn up the heat on politicians.
Jimmy, take over for a while, would you?
Yeah, no, it's interesting that your perceptions there, I think, are spot on, Jose. I was on the executive committee for the Republican Party, and not only the willingness of people that the party supports to get elected, the willingness of those individuals in office to bend to the, I would say, the powerful lobbies or the perceptions and the actual plethora of political consultants that are out there that are trying to shift you and shape you into something. I think that's really challenging, as well as the pettiness and the personal issues that really neglect the best interests of the people for individual concerns. And I think it's incredibly damaging to objectives that benefit the country. But most people don't understand what's going on behind the scenes. And I think your point there is fantastic. What do you think people can do now to kind of push back against that, basically I'll say corruption in both parties, but in particular inside the Republican Party, with we see a number of people, senior leaders, that bow down to the lobbyist pressures at the, you know, negative benefit of their own constituents. How do we work with that?
Well, I would say you fight fire with fire, in that people should become grassroots lobbyists, if you will, in that they should go to their city council, county commission, and get more politically involved, learn what are the issues of the day in your respective locality, find like-minded people, and build organizations from scratch, attend these meetings, expose politicians that betray their constituents, and also expose bad public policy that's being passed, because ultimately all politics starts locally. You're not going to capture D.C., but you have a better chance of potentially having an impact in your city council or county commission, and then you build a network, because politics, it does boil down to networks due to the fact that a lot of the really bad policies we see implemented wherever, from your city council all the way to like the state legislature, are being promoted by interest groups, which represent a network of people, big donors and other people. So you kind of have to build like a parallel institution, if you will, to combat that. And there's a lot of issues that do rile up disaffected conservatives and other people in the political spectrum. And the way people can mount resistance is by being more engaged with your local community. Because if you really think about it, the ruling class wants us always online talking, smack-talking other people and engaging in unproductive behavior, because then we just waste all of our energy while these people in the ruling class can get away with a lot of mischief behind the scenes. But in contrast, when you get more engaged in the community and in your local politics, you're able to actually forge real world relationships and build long-term institutions that can counter the political establishment.
You know, I think one of the bigger challenges that are out there is basically the, and I think you allude to it in a number of your writings, that, you know, free speech is dead. We're being crushed by tech companies. The way that a lot of politicians get their message out or try to get their message out is through social media and through, you know, just low tech, low cost efforts that are being really silenced or at least shadow banned. That seems to me to be something that's really shaping local politics as well as national politics, and it's beginning to become, you know, incredibly damaging to a republic. We've got about a minute left. I just thought your thoughts, if we want to get started for now, to go into the next segment too, well, on free speech and silencing speech.
Yeah, Jimmy, we've only got a minute left, so I'd like to take a break here for a commercial. I want you to think about one question, Jose, that I would like to go into the second segment with, and that is the basic question of your article, which is, purely and simply, are the neocons still in control? And then, as Jim just alluded, Jose, free speech is really seemed to me to be on the ropes right now. Your article, Free Speech is Dead in This One Country, is a very interesting article. At least the topic points sure point to a lot of interest on my part. It's a real pleasure, Jose, I want to say, to have you on the program. I love the guys from the Mises Institute. I am so thankful that Ron Paul, who is not necessarily closely associated with Mises, Ron is involved with the Ron Paul Institute for Freedom and Prosperity. I have a lot of time for Ron Paul. He is a real American, in my opinion, and I admire him greatly. Stick around, you guys. We'll be right back.
your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Back to continue KER politics with Jose Nino. Let's talk about the basic question real quick, Jose. Are the neocons really still in control?
It's interesting because when you saw the election of Donald Trump in 2016, the neocons did take somewhat of a body blow because Trump ran a pretty anti-neocon platform when it came to not engaging in new, never-ending nation-building experiments abroad. That said, there was a residual neocon element within his administration that roadblocked him with regards to the Afghanistan withdrawal and other measures that would have retrenched a lot of America's presence abroad, which I believe does not serve any pressing American interests. Now, fast forward to the Russo-Ukrainian conflict. You have seen a consolidation of both parties when it comes to pumping a bunch of military aid into Ukraine in order to effectively have Ukraine fight Russia to the last Ukrainian and try to draw into a really nasty proxy conflict that could potentially spread across Europe and maybe create a broader refugee crisis. It remains to be seen if they will fully realize that vision. There are some people that are definitely crazy enough to want NATO to get involved, potentially turn this conflict into a nuclear affair, but that also remains to be seen. These people are still in control. That said, I will note that there is a very strong alternative media ecosystem that has helped make a lot of the American populace become much more hesitant about getting into unnecessary conflicts abroad. And this type of alternative media space has really challenged the corporate media narrative and has made even some politicians much more gun-shy about committing U.S. resources, both direct and indirect, to get in a conflict that really doesn't serve a pressing American interest.
You know, I see, Jose, I see a very big, I think you're alluding to something that many people are trying to avoid from the Washington perspective and certainly from the neocon and the institutional party perspective. There is this incredibly growing frustration with the population. The facade is dropping. They're seeing what's behind the curtain, certainly with the Biden regime, the Biden administration, of the mistakes that have been made in the past. And I think there's a beginning to be a tremendous pushback from much of the population about these never-ending conflicts that not only do they drag on and drain resources and really hurt America, they kill Americans, they do damage to foreign, you know, locations, and then we walk away from them and lose. And I think that is incredibly disheartening for many Americans. And I'm seeing a pushback. You're seeing it in many, many places, with the exception of just inside that beltway and those major media corporations that continue to hype that. So I'm encouraged, actually, that people are starting to wake up and, you know, with some of these absolutely tremendous mistakes that are happening out there. It does come back to, though, who controls the narrative, and that's back to the media and the corporations that are kind of driving these agendas in support of a number of different, very influential interests.
I'm also pretty optimistic as well. I share your opinion because of the fact that you see much more people these days questioning a lot of like media narratives. Like if you went back to say in World War II when alternative media was in its gestational phase, there was not as much resistance to that. But now I think it's just so much harder for the ruling class to prosecute these kind of conflicts, especially when you're dealing with like a nuclear power like Russia, like to really get a lot of people to sign up for this, especially when you're dealing with a conflict where the U.S. was not directly attacked. That's even like doubly harder. So I'm actually pretty optimistic, and I think that as time goes by, even with all the censorship and whatnot, people will find a way to pierce through the ruling class's recount of events.
Jose, I'm curious about your second sentence in your commentary, free speech is dead in this country. What you say is, quote, rather it's a sober reflection of how hard the West has fallen. when it comes to protecting the foundational freedoms that once made it great. We've got about 3 minutes. Can you just talk about that briefly?
Yeah, to give context, this was an article I wrote for the Liberty Loft on how Germany banned, like literally, well, several states in Germany banned the letter Z, because the letter Z is decorated on Russian tanks and other military vehicles in the current Russian invasion of Ukraine. And so a lot of European lawmakers from Germany and even some Central European countries have passed legislation to ban this symbol and also ban any purported speech or statements that somehow express pro-Russian sentiments. And while this may seem reasonable to the average person whenever they talk about it in simple terms, I believe this is kind of like a Trojan horse for broader free speech violations. Because what if somebody, like, say, the international relations theorist John Mearsheimer, who warned about this conflict for years, starts to explain why Russia, tries to rationalize why Russia invaded Ukraine? That could be constituted as a, like, support for, like, pro-Russian objectives, and it could be prosecuted in those states. Like, anybody who tries to dispel the prevailing narrative could be subject to these penalties. And I think it is a form of decline, because the West, over the last 500 years or so, has valued the idea of freedom of speech, free inquiry, and the questioning of the reality in front of us as a way to, like, progress and build, like, our civilization. It's what made us unique. And by effectively banning speech, we have the U.S. and the collective West just becomes another form of oriental despotism that you see, whether it's in communist China or even Russia. We effectively become what we fight against. And it's a sad state of affairs, but I believe that's what's happening across the West, where the ruling classes have largely abandoned many of the principles that made Western civilization great and unique among civilization states.
Hey guys, we got to take a real quick break for the top of the hour news. Jimmy, we got a minute. You want to wrap it up?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I think it's happening here in America as well. You know, the bastion of free speech, at least where that had began through our Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and these things to do it, where we see people screaming and yelling about, gender identity, and you can't say something against, you know, misgender somebody. We're seeing it in the January 6th issues, people that actually protested rightly being attacked with Justice Department and being called, you know, insurrectionists by major mainstream figures and politicians.
That is absolutely wrong. You guys were out of time. Better take a break for the top of the hour news. Jose, you're going to be back. Thank you very much.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome back. Hope you guys enjoyed the top of the hour news. Back with Jimmy. We're going to talk in this particular segment about a couple of things. What's going to happen to the world economy if, in fact, Russia, for all practical purposes, shuts off the gas supply, which I don't think is going to happen. Jimmy, let's get your comment first, and then I'll jump in.
Yeah, so the 31st of March, Vladimir Putin announced that he'd only take gold and rubles for oil or for gas supplies to Europe. And of course, as you know, most everybody has learned, the Germans already knew, but about 70% of their energy supplies come from Russia, 60-70%. So that's a huge impact for them. They've made a declared statement already, the Germans, that they will move away from the Russian dependency. That is something that Donald Trump had actually reprimanded not only the Germans, but NATO in general for back in 2017 and 2018 rather significantly. He made a very, very important warning that this could put Europe at a very huge risk against a potential enemy.
Yeah.
So what we're seeing now is that coming to fruition. Russia is threatening. I think it's a, if in fact they do stop delivery of gas, they have to continue to sell to get the revenues to support their operations and continue to operate their government. That would be very challenging to do. They do have Chinese and Indian purchases that are committed right now. So we'll see how that works. I don't know how long those countries would be able to use hard currency, being gold, or if it would be in credits. But the impact will certainly increase inflation in the price of fuels. And of course, as you see the price inflationary pressure on energy, that affects, you know, petroleum and gas, that affects every aspect of our lives. So we could see a significant increase over the next few months of not only prices in energy and gas and fuel, but also in all the products that are produced and all the transportation costs that are associated with that. And that comes on top of a supply chain crisis, that comes on top of, you know, very, very rapid inflation because of this massive influx of dollars pumped out by the Fed and by the Biden administration for COVID response. You know, in spite of some of the hype that there is a reduction in the deficit, that's only because the Biden plan didn't go through. We are facing a very serious and very difficult summer, and a lot of people, as President Biden said publicly, that you may see food shortages, you may see more supply shortages, you're going to see increases in oil prices and gas prices. Now, he did announce that he would pump a million barrels of oil a day from the national stockpile, the emergency reserve stockpile, into the economy over the next 8 months, which actually brings our overall expenditures from the national stockpile, oil stockpile, the energy stockpile, that takes about 40% to 50%, given this large amount, which could equate to as much as of 180 million barrels, and what he's previously done is 30 million barrels. That's significantly reducing the national stockpile, which is designed specifically in case of global war. And we are facing the potential for global war. It makes absolutely no sense what's happening at all now, unless you look at it from a Green New Deal perspective, where they
Go ahead. Let me jump in on this Green New Deal thing. That's not going to last forever, and it's not going to work forever. I mean, renewable energy sources, windmills, et cetera, number one, it's going to take a lot of time to ramp it up, and I firmly am convinced that renewable energy sources it's simply too big a change to make overnight. You know, you're always going to, I mean, Mercedes-Benz, for example, announced that within 6 or 7 years, all of their cars will be electric. Well, let me tell you, the value of the conventional gas Mercedes and BMW, for that matter, is going to scream higher and higher and higher, because that change cannot, you can make all your cars electric within 6 or 7 years, but the fact of the matter is the value of the conventional cars is going to scream to the moon. There's no question about that. I don't think renewables are going to work. I think what's going to happen in the United States under Trump was pretty oil self-sufficient. Now, I don't know how long, and I shouldn't have brought this up without knowing this, but I don't know how long that self-sufficient can continue. Self-sufficiency can continue. My guess is that it can continue for quite a while. So much for shutting down the pipeline, President Biden. so much for reducing drilling, so much, et cetera, for all your great green energy plans. They cannot occur overnight. They will not happen overnight. And I would believe that they will never happen in their entirety. Any comments on that, Jim?
Yeah, so I think we actually use estimated about 20 million barrels of oil a day in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Putting 1 million barrels a day back into the system for 6 months takes about half of our overall. That's about 180 million barrels. That's, you know, we're at about 400 to 500 million barrels in the national stockpile.
Right.
That lasts us maybe a year at most.
Yeah.
If we don't significantly increase production and reduce the pricing because of that, we are facing a very serious problem. Now, at 1 million barrels a day added into the stockpile, that only dropped, I think it dropped the price of oil in the commodities market less than, about 5% overall.
Yeah.
And it's only about a 5% change in price of gas at the pump. So let's say, you know, at a, I mean, that's a 25 cent drop from a $5 a gallon. If you're in California, you know, that's 30 cents off of your $7 a gallon gas.
Exactly.
35 cents off your $7
exactly.
a gallon. That's not doing anything for us when you've got an inflation rate last month at year over year at 7.9%. And we can expect to see that significantly increase as we actually face the reality of what's happened over the last 30 days. So this is a very, very difficult time. And I think what's happening is the boneheads in your current U.S. administration are trying to force green energy policies on people and do exactly what you say can't be done, make that happen overnight. I think they're trying to politically take advantage of it to appease a certain segment of the population and these people that believe that the world's coming to an end. I think this is a catastrophic mistake for national security and a catastrophic mistake for them politically in the short term, because people are beginning to get fed up when they're seeing through it.
Well, there's a question in my mind was whether the people are not getting fed up. Of course they're getting fed up. A lot of interesting things are happening politically that is getting people to really look in another direction. A lot of things are happening socially, et cetera, et cetera. I think we're going to see an awful lot of changes, Jimmy, in the very near future. By the way, I am going to post an article today by a fellow who writes he's a freelance writer, but he's very, very good. His name is Jose Nino. He's going to be on the program on Monday. Hopefully Jimmy can join me. He wrote a very, very interesting article that is germane to what we're talking about right now. It's entitled, "The Progressive Liberal Democracy Has Failed. Radical Decentralization is the Answer." And I agree with that 100%. Stick around. Jim and I are going to be right back after the commercial. Okay, here to wrap up KER Politics, two topics we want to discuss. One of them is the Durham investigation, which is really heating up. And Jimmy, if I'm not mistaken, hasn't the Clinton campaign pretty much been found in the wrong here already with a fine?
Yes, the Clinton campaign has been fined by the Federal Election Commission for basically fraudulently making statements about where their campaign funding went. Perkins Coie law firm as well was involved. And of course, this directly relates to Andrew Sussman, the Clinton campaign lawyer who has been indicted for lying to FBI agents.
Right.
This is very complex, but he's working his way diligently without the same resources that the Mueller special counsel had, without the number of investigators, but he's working diligently and he has not stopped. And it's becoming somewhat troublesome for the Democrats.
There's something else that's becoming somewhat troublesome from the Democrats, and that's this guy named Hunter Biden. In and out of the news, we talked in a daily editorial earlier in the week about you feel the Democrats are about ready to throw the guy under the bus. There's no question about that. I think they are. Once the conventional media starts to give him as much covering as coverage as he is getting, I think that proves that they've pretty much written him off. What are your comments on that, Jim?
So I think they were trapped. They were trapped because most of the mainstream media and many, many senior Democratic leaders, including 50 intelligence officers from the Obama administration, or Democratic operatives, basically, for the intelligence community, unfortunately, had claimed that this was Russian disinformation, that Hunter Biden's laptop information was actually a false flag story. Now, they're embarrassed by that. And the problem has become for the media and these same Democratic operatives that the facts are becoming clear. The Justice Department cannot back off on this investigation because it is too damning. There is way too much information there to ignore. And it directly, unfortunately, for the Democrats and Joe Biden, it directly links back to Joe Biden and his brother, Jim. There is quite a few emails and facts that actually intertwine their financial accounts. There is hundreds and thousands of links to direct contributions from Chinese Communist Party officials, including Chinese intelligence officials, funding some of these organizations. Joe Biden, as vice president, allowed Hunter Biden and his partners to fly an Air Force Two in order to make these contacts. And of course, when we go back to the Burisma $85,000 a month retainer for Hunter Biden to be on the board while Joe Biden was the responsible entity for Ukraine, you see a very compelling, almost impossible case to ignore. And what that means is the media has been embarrassed by it, but they're now trying to shift and turn blame to something else. And I think it's going to be, unfortunately for America and certainly for the Bidens, they're going to have to face the consequences at some point, though we all question the Merrick Garland Justice Department on how far they will pursue any of these actions. And that's where we all, got to worry about actually rule of law. And if you're privileged, you can get away with some of these incredible crimes.
With the stark raving evidence that's out there, Jimmy, it seems pretty straightforward to me. How can they possibly get away from pursuing that?
That's I think the question the media is asking itself right now, why they're beginning to report on it, because the evidence is clear. The information has been validated. Many of these news organizations that dismissed it have now had to go back and actually contact people that were the recipients of emails and finding out that, in fact, Hunter Biden was using his dad's accounts to pay for hookers, or his dad was using his accounts for illicit things, having offices shared, of course, travel and communication, and certainly making a massive amount of money off of his father's position as both vice president and then as a candidate running for president. So your question is a good one. How could this be ignored? It was really unbelievable that it was ignored when it first happened 2 years ago, because we're reaching about 2 years since this kicked off and the media completely ignored it. And I think there's a very interesting Jonathan Turley piece for anybody who wants to look at his blog that talks about Joe Biden and the disappearing elephant. Yeah. Joe Biden, the disappearing elephant. It's how he managed to, how the Democrats managed to do this, to basically silence everyone on it, which directly goes back to our point earlier on in the show with free speech.
Yeah.
Who's deciding what information is valid and real? And when the tech companies that have a political agenda to support their candidate or their ideology make that decision, they are canceling, as we saw with Twitter, you know, and all these different news agencies actually deleting stories and silencing people and calling them, you know, purveyors of Russian disinformation for presenting factual information on what has now proven to be absolutely true.
Yeah.
And this, and, you know, we get back to the initial discussion in this segment, the Durham investigation. So Andrew Sussman, the lawyer for the Clinton campaign, wrote and spoke falsely to not only to FBI agents, but went to James Baker, the FBI lawyer, and said, hey, I've got information. I'm doing this on my own. When in fact, he was getting paid for actually spreading this information. And he went to media companies as well. And this is based on the Alpha Bank scheme, which basically Democrats concocted an entire narrative that somehow the Trump campaign and the Trump offices were connecting with Alpha Bank, and that showed some sort of collusion with Russia in exchange of money, which was actually fabricated, and it's now proven to be fabricated information. But it doesn't just stop with Andrew Sussman. It goes to Rodney Jaffe, a tech executive that had actual contracts with the Department of Defense and the White House to manage their server tracks, to Georgia Tech investigators, to Mark Elias, another key Democratic lawyer, and of course, Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor, and Hillary Clinton herself. This could be very, very damaging and should be very damaging as more information comes out if the Durham investigation continues and people begin to start spilling the beans rather than face an entire decade or so behind bars for some of the fraud.
Okay, here's the $1 million question. $100,000 slap on the wrist to the Democratic Party that has, you know, assets well into the millions. Why only $100,000?
Yeah, that's a pretty sad number. All it does is just a symbolic fine to say that you were wrong and you lied. Again, it's the FEC is split between three and three, party type folks right now. Basically, anybody's inside Washington, they're protecting their own. And that's the unfortunate reality that we face today where people are getting away with this stuff. We've seen it over and over again with the Clinton server issue, with Benghazi, with, just numerous things. And, of course, the Russian collusion. And there are people still out there making these arguments.
Yeah.
The one good thing is that we're seeing some legal actions that are beginning to take hold in the courts that are actually holding some folks accountable, though it's going to be a long road to reestablish some integrity in our system.
Well, when you say it's going to be a long road, I mean, you're talking about, we've only got about 30 seconds here. We're talking years and years, Jimmy.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And, we have to change the way our government works and the transparency and really get people in there that are more concerned about integrity and honesty. And that's a hard thing to do because they get corrupted very rapidly.
Very definitely. Okay, Jim, thanks so much. Been fun doing the show. You guys have no idea how much fun it's been. Jimmy, thanks, bud.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.